We're in Advent now, so we're getting ready to celebrate Christmas. So is anyone excited for Christmas? Yes, all right. So I'm going to ask for a little bit of feedback now, hopefully better than that roaring applause for Christmas we just got. But what are some things that we're excited about? Any brave soul want to shout out? What are you excited for Christmas? Or are we all Scrooge here and we're like, you have to take work off and that's terrible. I'd rather make my employees work still.
The true meaning of Christmas.
Amen. That's good.
Family.
Family time, yeah. It's good. Families, true meaning of Christmas.
Yeah.
Food, yes. I was hoping someone was going to say that. Kelly is the best cook I know, and that's what I always look forward to with Christmas. And It's a Wonderful Life. Does anyone watch It's a Wonderful Life? It's a great movie. No, of course not. Of course no one watches the movies that I watch here at church. That's definitely the case. It's fantastic. Eggnog. Yeah. Oh, Elf. That's good, too. Yeah, Elf. There's all kinds of good Christmas movies. Eggnog is one of my favorite, though. I try to gain, in the 25 days of Christmas, at least 25 pounds over eggnog. That's always my goal. My goal with Christmas. What are some other things? Our Christmas Eve service. That's something that I really look forward to also each year, where we get together as a community and kind of ring in Christmas with the last service before Christmas. It's when we light the center candle, the Christ candle there for Advent. But I notice whenever we're going through this idea of what are we looking forward to with Christmas, you never hear anyone say, I'm looking forward to the kids screaming bloody murder 5 minutes after opening their present because it broke already, you know? Or I'm looking forward to being stressed out with my spouse, but how are we going to pay the credit card bill that we just racked up? Or on a more serious note, the people that are realizing this is the first Christmas that there's going to be someone missing at the dinner table for whatever reason. So the truth is, like, Christmas is this weird tension that Aaron already hinted at, where it's the most joyous time of year. It's when we all look forward to some of our best memories. And at the same time, there's more tension and there's more pressure than there is in any other 25-day span. And so what we're going to do tonight is we're going to kind of pull back from that and look at what is the source of this tension, right? Because basically we all have this idea in our head of what we want Christmas to be. Okay, we used to talk about the picture-perfect Christmas as something we want to look just right. Okay, but now in our digital age where we can post stuff to Facebook and we can post stuff to Pinterest and we can get all these outside sources that tell us what their Christmas is like, the pressure to have a great Christmas, to have the perfect Christmas, has just ratcheted it up 10 times more. I mean, infinitely more than it used to be. So now we have this thing like the Pinterest perfect Christmas. You like that? That's pretty clever. Huh? A little pun there, the Pinterest perfect Christmas. But like what this is in our digital age, we have all these outside sources that are saying, if you're going to have a good Christmas, it has to look like this. If your turkey doesn't look like this, then you've failed. Okay, if your kids don't look a certain way when you're getting ready to celebrate Christmas, then you've failed. If you don't have a mound of presents under your tree, then you've failed. Or how about this one, guys? If your wife doesn't get a Lexus in her driveway with a big red bow, then you are a miserable failure. I can't believe you even tried this year. At least go to Zales or Jared or whichever one that is. But so I wanted to kind of illustrate what we're talking about here. I have some family photos to show you because it's Christmas. We like to talk about family pictures. So this is our about a year and a half ago, our cute little kids. And Natalie actually took this picture. And so this is one of our best photos of our children. Everyone's smiling. Everyone's happy. It's like it's the Pinterest perfect picture, right? This is the stuff you post to Facebook and you get 1,000 likes on it. But what no one sees is the picture that Natalie took right after this, which you can see Hudson screaming, and you can't see how red his eyes are in the picture very well, but he is not having a good time at all. Okay, and this was like mere seconds after the other one. And so you also can't see is his mom and dad behind the camera saying, Hudson, stop crying, stop crying, stop crying, stop crying, and getting more and more frustrated that he's yelling and he's ruining the family photos. And so there's this, like again, it's this tension we're trying to work at where there's this image we present to everyone of my life is so perfect. We have the perfect Christmas, and if only everyone could be just like us. But then if you scratch below the surface of all of our Christmases, it's credit card bills, you know, it's family tension, it's your spouse being more distant than you would like them to be, it's your kids not behaving. There's all this stuff that really ratchets up the pressure on it. And so what's happening is, what is all this stuff? Why is it that everyone is looking for Lexuses, or whatever the plural of Lexus is, and diamonds, and these, all these presents, and all this amazing stuff? What it is that we all have this inward sense in us that recognizes that we're trapped in darkness and that our souls desperately long for light. And so what we're doing is, as a nation, there's 300 million of us groping around in the darkness trying to find the one thing that's going to bring us happiness. It's going to bring us the joy that we sing about with this season. You know, we think, you know, if we have, again, all the right presents, all the right situations, the right meals, the right family photos, that that's going to bring us the light that we desperately need. Okay, but what the Bible tells us is something quite different. It's that we're in darkness. The darkness is a result of sin. And that what we really need is the light that can only come from the Messiah. Okay, the Messiah, that's a word you hear a lot at Christmas. That just means it's the anointed one. It's the coming Savior of Israel that was prophesied hundreds and hundreds of years before Jesus was actually born. And so what we're talking about tonight is this idea of the light that we all know we need, the bondage that we feel within us because of the darkness that is just below the surface in all of our Christmases. So as we get into the word tonight, I'm going to say a prayer for us, and then we're going to study in Isaiah tonight. So bow your heads. Dear Lord, thank you for your love for us tonight. Thank you for each person here in this room that we're coming from so many different places, so many different phases of life and types of weeks we've just come through. But I pray that as we hear your word read over us, that your Holy Spirit would convict us of the darkness in our own lives, and it would point us towards the true light that is found in your Son. And it's your glorious name we pray. So we are going to start off in Genesis tonight before we get to Isaiah. So Genesis chapter 3, if you want to flip there. And if you've been around here at all very long, we've come to Genesis 3 quite a bit. It's because it's one of the most theologically significant chapters in the whole Bible. So Genesis, it's one of the first pages. Genesis is the first book. So if you don't have a Bible, there should be one on your table, and you can flip there or scroll there if you're on your phone or however you're getting there these days. So we're starting off with the darkness of Christmas, okay, which is kind of a weird way to begin an Advent series. But if you don't understand the darkness, you'll never appreciate the light. Okay, so that's why, like, the light has the greatest benefit to you when you've just come through the darkest places. So where we're going to start with the Bible tonight is right in where it begins, right in the darkest chapter of the Bible. So Genesis chapter 3, and we're going to pick it up in verse 16. This is after Adam and Eve ate of the fruit that God commanded them not to. Then this is God speaking to the woman. He says, "To the woman he said, 'I will surely multiply your pain and childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you.' And to Adam he said, 'Because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground. For out of it you were taken. For you are dust, and to dust you shall return.'" So again, like I said, we're going to start off with the darkness of Christmas, which I feel a little bit like that Home Alone. Has anyone seen Home Alone? I'm going to try to keep trying with movies here. So there's that black and white movie scene, the guy with the big Tommy gun, and he shoots him full of holes, and he's like, "Merry Christmas, you filthy animal." That's kind of what this feels like. We read this verse, like, there's pain and childbearing, the weeds and thorns are going to come, your life is going to be terrible because of sin. Merry Christmas, guys. How does that feel? Okay, and again, I said the reason we're starting here is because if you don't understand the darkness, you don't appreciate the light. And Christmas is about the light of the Messiah and the light that he brings, the light that we're all searching for from all so many different ways. And so, in some sense, what we've just read is what has followed the first Christmas verse. So flip back one page or just go up a few verses to chapter 3, verse 15. And this is the verse we normally camp out on a lot. It's a really, really significant verse. It says, "I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. And he shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." So this is God speaking to the serpent, to the devil, and he's telling Satan that there's going to be an offspring of the woman who's going to come, a descendant of Eve, who is going to crush the head of the devil. That's just symbolic for saying he's going to defeat evil once and for all. Okay, this is the first Christmas verse in the Bible. It's pointing to the fact that sin entered the world, that darkness now exists because of the sin that we have been born into and that we freely follow. But because of this verse, Jesus is prophesied. It says that God is pointing out that there will be a Messiah who will come and who will save all of mankind. He will crush the head of the serpent. He will defeat evil once and for all. So like I said, that's where Christmas really begins. It's way back at the beginning. As soon as sin entered the world, God had a plan for redemption. Okay, this was not God's plan B. It wasn't like he was trying to think of what to do next because, oh my gosh, they made this horrible mistake. Right from the very beginning, God had a plan to save us from the darkness that we're experiencing. Okay, so that's Genesis chapter 3. For the next 500 pages, or however many are in your Bible, leading up to the New Testament, what it is it's God's people working out what does it look like for evil to be defeated. Okay, if the serpent's head is going to be crushed, how is that going to happen? And so God reveals himself in more clear and more clear steps as we progress through the Bible. And with each of these, it gets a better and better picture of who this person is that's going to crush the head of the serpent. And so tonight when we get to Isaiah, what's happened is this has been, there's been hundreds and hundreds of years of Israel trying to work out what does it mean to follow God. And at this point in their history, it's one of the darkest times that they've ever experienced. The nation of Israel has been divided into two, and now their enemies are closing in around them. The enemies are at their borders, and they're feeling the pressure, the weight of this darkness that is starting to encroach upon their kingdom, and they're experiencing, instead of the blessing of God, they're experiencing his discipline. So because of that, again, the darkness is becoming more and more clear. Okay, again, I keep harping on this idea of darkness, and what it is it's the idea that the weightier you recognize sin is, the greater the release from it is when we see what the Messiah has done. So think of it like a catapult. You know, the more tension there is holding it down, when that tension's released, the further the object is thrown. So in that some sense, the Old Testament, what it's doing is it's adding more and more weight to the catapult. It's ratcheting up the tension to show you how big of a mess we're in. And if you read the Old Testament, you see how big a mess that is. Like, humans left to their own design make nothing but destruction and wreak havoc everywhere we go. Okay, look at our world around us. Things are not going well, and it's because we think we're in charge. Okay, and wherever we are in charge, havoc and destruction is all we leave in our wake. So in some sense, Israel, and this when Isaiah is prophesying to this kingdom, they are in a completely different setting than us. They're worried about literal armies and bands of people coming and killing their kids, killing themselves, of plundering their kingdom. They have all these real threats. But what I want us to see tonight is that our threats are no less real. They just look much different. Okay, in some sense, our threats are more dangerous because it's easy to see when a guy is running at you with a sword. What it's not easy to see is when you're watching a commercial and your heart starts to make an idol out of something that some advertiser is telling you you need in order to be significant. Okay, it's not as easy to see when you're becoming more and more distant from your spouse because you don't want to deal with the hard issues of debt and all the problems that are coming up with your kids. Okay, like when you're going through a hard season of life, like those things that gnaw at your soul, those are harder to see. And because of that, I think they're almost more destructive. Okay, so when we read this verse in Isaiah, this passage in Isaiah, I want us to realize and to connect with the darkness that exists in our own souls. Isaiah is talking about a very different time period, but you'll see that it's what it's pointing to, the light that it's pointing to, is something that we all need in our own souls. And so that is why we do Advent. Okay, the reason we're taking a break from Mark and we're going to put that on hold for the next 5 weeks is because Christmas is a time where the church has historically set aside these 5 weeks, 4 weeks plus Christmas Eve, leading up to Christmas, saying, what happened on Christmas morning is so important that we need to pause from whatever we're doing. We need to reflect on the tension that we feel in our own souls so we can greater appreciate what it means for the Messiah to come and save us. Okay, so again, as we read these verses, reflect on the darkness that we feel in our own souls, the different types of attacks that come against us. So we're in Isaiah chapter 9, the same passage that the Mullins read to us, and what might have been the cutest Advent reading I've ever heard in my life. Samantha was adorable. So we're Isaiah chapter 9, and I forgot to write down the page number. So if someone can find Isaiah 9 and shout out the page number, that'd be great. 369, page 369, if you have the table Bible, is where we're at. And I'm going to read these first few verses, starting in verse 2. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shined. You have multiplied the nation. You have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as they are glad when they divide the spoil. For the yoke of his burden and the staff of his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. For every boot of the tramping warrior in battle tumult and every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire. Okay, so this prophecy, Isaiah is speaking about something that will happen in the future. And he says that those of us that are trapped in a deep darkness will see a great light. Okay, this darkness that's in all of our souls, there's a great light that's coming. So what Isaiah is describing here is what it looks like, the light that everyone needs. This is the light that we're all searching. When you go and buy that new car and think that it's going to bring you happiness, what you're doing is you're looking for light. You're groping in the darkness, hoping you can find some light. Okay, when you think you have the perfect Christmas dinner set out for everyone and that will finally make your family have this wonderful time together, if you make that an end in of itself, then what you're doing is you're groping in the darkness looking for some light. And what Isaiah is describing here is what it looks like when the true light actually comes. So let's look at what he's saying that in verse 9 or 3. He says that the nation will be multiplied. Okay, so Israel is worried about their enemies coming across their borders. And he's saying the nation will be multiplied. Big nations don't get attacked, especially in this day and age. If you have a big nation, you have a big army and you can defend yourself. So there's peace. You don't have to worry about your enemies coming and knocking down your door. Okay, then he says that that as with joy at the harvest. Okay, there's joy at the harvest and that they're glad when they divide the spoil. Okay, so this whole nation is just consumed with this wonderful feeling of joy. And it's at the harvest. It's when you reap your crops and you have a wonderful harvest that brings plenty of provision for the coming year. So that's the harvest. But then it's also the spoils of war. They've had military success and a successful harvest. What he's saying here is both extremes of life. That they are successful in peacetime and they're successful in wartime. God is blessing this people. They're seeing the light of how much power he has. And because of that, verse 4 describes the oppression that Israel's under. So Israel's going to go into exile from here. They're going to literally be slaves for hundreds of years again, just like in Egypt. And what he's prophesying here is that this yoke of slavery will be broken. Okay, the rod of the oppressor will be broken. It says, as on the day of Midian. Okay, now, the Midianites oppressed Israel hundreds of years before this prophecy was said. Okay, and that's when the time of Gideon. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that story, but Gideon is one of the most amazing stories of God's miraculous deliverance of Israel. So the Midianites had thousands and thousands and thousands of people that were oppressing Israel. And then God chose Gideon, and he said, I want you to get an army. So Gideon got 32,000 people and said, all right, we can go take on these Midianites now. And then God said, that's not miraculous enough if you win, so I want you to get rid of all of them. And so through this process, he whittles Gideon's army down from over 30,000 to 300. And they're going to go fight thousands and thousands of the Midianites. And then God does this miraculous thing, and he saves Israel from the Midianites. 300 people defeat this huge army, and it's because of the power of God. So what Isaiah is doing here is he's saying the deliverance that's going to come for you is going to be just as miraculous, if not more, as it was in the days of Gideon. Okay, now this is what all of our hearts are still longing for. Okay, we want to believe in miracles just like that. Okay, the reason Christmas has its own magical sphere is because we want to believe that there should be some time of year where all your relationships start to go better, right? Where you get the things you need, where people are kind to each other, where there's peace in your home. Okay, that's that kind of miracle that we're all still looking for. And what Isaiah is prophesying here is he's saying that this light that we're all searching for will in fact come one day. We can rest assured and we can have hope because the light will in fact come. Okay, so but now look at our own lives. Okay, how is this working out for us? How is our nation doing with this idea of the light coming? Because again, we all need this light. We all know that we're trapped in darkness and we're trying to find some way to bring us into the light. But here's one example. If you have credit card debt in America, you have almost $16,000 worth of it. Okay, so that's $16,000 worth of stuff that you've said, if I'll go out and buy that, then I will be in the light. I will no longer be trapped in this darkness. Okay, it's easy to talk about debt because it's quantifiable. You can put a number on that. Okay, but what about the darkness that we experience with our relationships? You know, our approval addictions, our the fights we have with our neighbors, the tension we feel at work. If you, again, what I've been trying to point us to this whole time is if you engage our culture, look at our world, and don't even look at our world, look at your own soul. We know that there's darkness that's all around us. Everyone is searching for this light that Isaiah is describing here. It's the light that everyone wants. But instead, we feel this sense of darkness around us. And the reason, okay, why are we not being able to find it? Is because the light that everyone wants can only be found in the Messiah that everyone needs. Okay, the Messiah is the only one that can bring this light that he's talking about. And when we search for it in other places, we're left just with our own destruction and our own misery. So let's see. He's been describing what the culture will look like when the Messiah comes. This is the light, what it's going to look like. And it paints a beautiful picture of what we want. Okay, it's this kind of peace and freedom and success and bounty and wealth. But then he's going to shift gears now, moving on to verse 6, and he's going to say that the light that we all want can only be found in the one Messiah that's the one that brings the true light. So this is where he shifts gears in verse 6. Let's read that. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder. And his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end. On the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. Okay, that's a picture of the character of the Messiah that can bring this light that we're all searching for. Okay, we don't have to be trapped in darkness anymore because this Messiah is going to bring this light that we all need. And he's going to come in the form of a child. Okay, a child is going to be born. The innocence, the weakness, the vulnerability of a child is going to be the one who ushers in this new light, this kingdom that he's talking about. And he's going to have the government resting on his shoulders. What that's saying is he's going to rule as a king in the line of David. So David was the most successful king that Israel ever had. And the Messiah was going to be a descendant of his that was going to restore the kingdom that David had, only infinitely more successful. Okay, David never experienced the kind of peace that this passage is talking about. But his offspring that's going to come, that Isaiah is predicting his birth as a child, he's going to bring this new kingdom in and bring in this light that everyone has been looking for. And then he goes and he lists four different names. In this ancient world, they were called throne names. When a king was coronated, he would take for himself names that he thought would characterize his rule. But what Isaiah is doing is saying that the throne names of the Messiah have already been chosen for him. Before he's even born, these names are going to characterize what the rule of the Messiah looks like. And here we go. He's going to be called Wonderful Counselor. Okay, that means he has infinite wisdom. His wisdom is going to always produce the best plan. Okay, so much tragedy comes when our leaders produce bad plans. And that was so true for Israel as well. What the Messiah is going to do is he's going to be a wonderful counselor. He's going to have great plans that always work. He's going to be called Mighty God. Now, some people try to twist this and say, oh, that just means like a God-like person. Okay, but the problem is everywhere else in Isaiah, when he uses the expression Mighty God, he's talking about the Mighty God, how mighty God is. He's saying that this Messiah is going to be God. Okay, this is a huge, like, mind-blowing game changer for the people of Israel. It's this prophecy that the Messiah is going to be God. And then it says he'll be Everlasting Father. Okay, now that doesn't mean like the Father is in the third person of the Trinity or first person of the Trinity. But what he's saying is a father is someone who's benevolent and loving and looks after what's the best interest of his people. Okay, and his fatherhood will be everlasting. He will always be taking care of his people like that. And then the last one that it gives is he'll be the Prince of Peace. Then it says that of the increase of his government and of peace, there will be no end. Okay? Now, this word peace is shalom. And if you're around the church at all, I'm sure you've heard this word because it's so significant. Okay? The Hebrew people were looking for shalom. Shalom, we translate it peace, but it means so much more than just peace. It's not the lack of conflict. What shalom is it's the flourishing of everything in the way that it was created to be. It's all the relationships working together the way they were designed to. Okay, it's your crops flourishing the way that they were supposed to without weeds. It's your job being fruitful and beneficial. It's your spouse loving you and you loving them. And it's everything in society, government working correctly. I mean, yeah, whatever it is, like everything. Okay, everything's a pretty encompassing term, but that's what shalom means, is everything working the way that it was designed to by God so that human beings could flourish. Okay, and this is that this king will establish justice and righteousness and that it will go on forever. Okay, forevermore, eternity will be characterized by this type of shalom. This Messiah, who's this wonderful counselor, mighty God, everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, he's going to usher in this shalom that never ends. And I want to pause for a second and talk about that one word. It says, with justice and righteousness. Okay, justice is something that we hardly ever talk about in church anyway, but it's so, so significant. Okay, justice is, you know, the bad guys getting what their due and the good guys getting what their due. Okay? And the problem is if you look in our world, we never see that kind of justice. So there's a band, I'm not going to ask if anyone's heard of them because I know you don't connect with anything pop culture that I do, but there's a band out there called Need to Breathe that are awesome. I highly recommend listening to them. But they have this song where they're talking about justice, and they're using this metaphor of life being like a book. And the song goes, "Beg the book to turn the page, because I get stuck where the villains get away. Somewhere in this wretched tale, there must be a line where the victim gets his way just one time." Okay, this idea of the villain and the victim. And it seems like the villains always get their way, and the victims never do. And if you look at the deepest, darkest, hardest chapters of your life, the deepest pain that you have, it's where you've been the victim, and the villains got away, okay, where justice wasn't served. Okay, and what that is that's reflecting this truth that the Messiah hasn't yet come to reign fully. Okay, this justice we do not yet experience. So for you conservatives in the room, okay, it's the Lois Lerner, is that, I think that's her name, the IRS scandal, where she was going after Tea Party groups and trying to nail them to the wall. And all the conservative movement got all up in arms and said, this is unjust. Like, they're singling us out. They're coming after us. That's not what government was designed to do. And they had this righteous indignation about justice and the lack of it. But I think also, and this is going to be a little bit uncomfortable for us, but I think it's good. If you look at the Ferguson situation right now, that's the exact same thing that's going on. Okay, I'm not condoning violence or burning stuff in the streets or any of that stuff. But the fact that a people feels like they don't get justice, that they don't get, I mean, that the villain gets away and the victim doesn't get what he's due. Okay, that's why they're reacting that way. So like, I'm not trying to make a political statement here and condone anything. But what I am trying to do is say, as Christians, we need to be people who recognize justice for what it is. Okay, not a partisan justice or a political justice, but a God-ordained shalom that says the reign of God is going to bring justice and righteousness. And it's not truly justice if it isn't take care of the victims. So that's true for us on a personal scale. Again, the times we've been harmed, the times we've been wronged, where we are the victims. But it's also true with this prophecy. It's talking about a global scale where the kingdom of the Messiah will bring justice forevermore. Once and for all, the shalom will reign and we will all flourish the way that we were designed to. Okay, and that's what this Messiah is going to bring with him. Okay, so let's go back to this, to how we started tonight, and this idea of the Pinterest perfect Christmas. Okay, that's a little bit more silly than this big grand scale talking about justice. But what it is pointing to is that the reason we're all looking for that, the reason we scroll through Facebook and see how we stack up against all of our peers, is because we want to know that we have significance. Okay, we want to know that the light that we're searching for, we want to know that maybe the light is going to shine on us just a little bit this Christmas. Okay, but what I've been trying to do tonight to show is that this light that everyone is searching for, you can't find it in any of the things that the advertisers tell you is going to bring you light. That only brings deeper and deeper darkness for your soul. Instead, the light that we all need can only be found in the Messiah who brings the light that we're all searching for. That's the only place where we can truly find the Messiah. Okay, so what I'm trying to tell us to do tonight then is to stop looking for light in all the wrong places. Okay, when we're heading into Christmas, I'm sure some of us are tired from our Black Friday shopping still, and we have all this crazy stuff that our culture is pushing us, saying, if you do this, you'll have the perfect Christmas. But what we do for Advent when we celebrate this season is we pull back from that and say, that doesn't bring light of any kind. That only leaves us trapped in darkness. And that darkness is what we're trying to escape. And the only escape can be found in this Messiah that we all desperately need. Okay, so the takeaway from this is a little bit simple, okay? It's stop looking for light in the world's way and focus this Christmas on the light that the Messiah brings. Okay, now how we work that out, though, as individuals will look completely different for all of us. Okay, I'm not in any way saying boycott Christmas, right? Like, I don't want you to go home and throw your stockings in the fire and then take your tree out to the wood chipper or anything like that. Christmas is a good thing. Okay, but instead of using Christmas as an end in of itself, let's look back to, like TJ was saying, what the reason for Christmas is. Okay, the only reason we're doing this is because it's this time where the whole nation pauses and we celebrate and remember the coming of the Messiah who brought with him the light that we're all after. Okay, so in that sense, like I said, it's going to look different, but this Christmas season, press into what God is telling you. What can you do to make your Christmas truly significant? Okay, not in the Pinteresty sort of way, not in the Facebook sort of way, not in the Lexus sort of way, but if you're going to buy a Lexus, I hope I didn't ruin anyone's Christmas morning surprise. I'm not sure if that happens or not. But instead of going through all those places, look at what Christmas is designed to be, what it was really meant to be. It's this time where we celebrate the coming of the Messiah. Okay, and so what we need to do for that, and this is the only practical tip I'm going to give you tonight, because the rest of it I think is incredibly personal between you and God. The practical thing we all need to do is we need to come to church this Advent. Okay, there's so many busy things that can go on that can ruin our schedules, but it's so important. Okay, not for any selfish reasons. I mean, I love it when you guys are here. It's lonely when you guys aren't here, each one of you. But the reason I want you to come is because the best thing for your soul is to pause from the schedule of shopping, of baking, of trying to pay off credit card debt, and instead look at these candles and the significance that they represent of hope, of peace, of love, of joy, and the joy that can only be found in what that center candle represents. The Christ, the Messiah, is the only one that can bring this true light, because the light that everyone's searching for can only be found in the Messiah that everyone needs, and that's what the point of Christmas is. So let's turn to our discussion tables now, and I have three questions for you. The first one is just, like, let's engage this idea of what our culture presents as the true meaning of Christmas. So, the false meaning of Christmas. So what are some of the false lights that our culture presents around Christmas? I've used a few examples of the Lexus that everyone thinks we all need. And then what darkness are they trying to cover? Okay, when you look for that mound of Christmas presents for your kids, what darkness are you trying to cover by engaging that consumerism? Secondly, how can we keep our gaze on Jesus this season? Okay, so if what consumerism does is it presents all these distractions from the true meaning of Christmas, if all these commercials present distractions, what are some practical things you can do this Advent to keep your gaze on Jesus instead of all the stuff you need to do? Okay, whether it's Advent readings or whatever it is, engage that as your table. And then lastly, as always, respond to the passage. What is God teaching you specifically? And then if you have any questions, let me know, and then we'll bring it back together. All right, guys. Hope your discussions were good. All A-plus conversations, I'm sure. And and continue to engage these questions as you leave here. It's always good to talk about the significance of the passage in particular, because the reason we gather together is because what God tells us to hear through his word is way more important than anything else that I can say. So again, respond to the passage. That's probably the most important question we try to get to every week. As we wrap up tonight, I want us to kind of just pause again for a second. I know I've been saying that a lot, pause, right? But that's what Advent is all about. So let's stop and think for a little bit about this idea of what the Messiah is going to bring. Okay, so the light that everyone is searching for is only found in the Messiah that everyone needs. And let's be honest, though. Doesn't this seem a little bit outlandish? I mean, where peace will go forever and ever and never end. Okay, where his counsel is perfectly wise, there's never anything wrong with it. Okay, where there's no more war, there's no more famine, there's no more strife or tragedy. I mean, elsewhere in Isaiah, he talks about there being a place where there's no more tears. There's nothing ever wrong. I mean, you stop and think about that, and you're like, that sounds really good. And that sounds just as phony as the rest of this Pinterest perfect stuff we're talking about. I mean, who can really bring that? And if you look at it, it's been a long time now since Jesus has come, and we still have a lot of wars, we still have a lot of tragedy going on, which, wow, I'm a great salesman for Christianity up here, right? And saying, this is what the heck's going on. Okay, but the reason I'm pointing this out is because we all recognize that tension. Okay, like Aaron mentioned a little bit ago, Advent is a season of embracing the tension of this, what theologians call the already but not yet. Okay, we live in this time that the Messiah has already come, but the things that he's pointing to in this passage have not yet been realized. Okay, and so in that sense, that's why we still see darkness in our world, and in some extent, darkness in our own hearts. So what hope do we have that all of this will turn out the way that God says it will? Okay, well, if you notice, we left off the last little bit of verse 7 in chapter 9. So look there one last time. This is after he gets done describing what the kingdom's going to look like and who the king is going to be, what his character is going to look like. And he says, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. So he has this outlandish prophecy that seems too good to be true. And then he ends it with this promise that says, the zeal of the Lord will do this. He's saying you can count on this. The zeal of God is going to bring this about. Now, that word zeal is amazing. Okay, what it means literally is to become intensely red. Okay, so is that being so filled with emotion about something that your face just flushes red and you're like, I'm going to do this. Okay, this is going to happen. Okay, now what the Lord of hosts, the God of everything, when he thinks about the kingdom that he's going to bring in at the end of time, his face, and metaphorically speaking, gets flushed red, and he is confident knowing, I am going to get this done. We have the promise of Almighty God that when his kingdom comes, it's going to look just like he described it. It's going to be better than we can ever imagine because the zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. Okay, that is a promise that we can rest on. And as we enter this Advent season, as we go through this, and we see all the chaos around us, we can come back and remind ourselves, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. The Messiah has come. Light has entered our darkness. And we can rest assured that God will bring his kingdom to this glorious completion because of the zeal that he feels for his own glory. So what we're going to do now is we're going to, again, transition into a time of communion. And communion was prophesied thousands of years before, when God says in Genesis 3 that the Messiah will crush the head of the serpent. Okay, what we do when we come up for take communion every week is what we're remembering, is we're celebrating the fact that the head of the serpent was crushed on the cross. Okay, that was the first step of the zeal of the Lord bringing about this kingdom that he promised. And so when you take these elements, you're not just doing some symbol that reminds you of something important. What you're doing is you're proclaiming the fact that Satan was defeated on the cross and that God's kingdom will, in fact, be accomplished. It will, in fact, become a reality when he returns, what we're all waiting for. So please stand with me as we turn to take communion together. And for those of you that are new with us, we're so glad you're here. We love having visitors. One of the rules that the Bible lays down is that communion is only for those people who love Jesus. If you believe that you're a sinner apart from the grace of Christ, then we welcome you to the communion table. We'd love to have you come take the elements because you're on our team, because we're all on Jesus' team if you believe that Jesus is your Messiah. And so, but when you take these elements, again, we're proclaiming the Lord's death until he comes. So let's pray and just anticipate that coming of the King. Gracious Heavenly Father, I praise you that you're zealous for accomplishing your purposes. And though when we look around our world, it feels like we're losing, it feels like darkness is still reigning, we praise you that because of the cross, that the light has already come into the world, and that we can just bask in the glorious peace that comes, the shalom that exists in our own souls because of what your Son did on the cross. And it's out of joy now that we take these elements, celebrating the fact that death was defeated on the cross, and we can celebrate that kingdom as we await the Messiah.